This is the EWN Radio Network.
She's smart. She's successful. She's an executive. She's an entrepreneur. And she's the chief executive of her story. Who is she? She's you. Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network. Your Power Lunch Hour, keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Welcome to the Power Lunch, sponsored by Enterprise Capital, your business partner for all your small business financing needs. I'm your host, Mona Lisa Como, along with my handsome co-host and husband, Jay Como.
And so while I used to brag about the last few shows, this being a date night, it's a virtual date night as I'm on the East Coast on business, and my lovely co-host is in the home headquarters running the program board. And the next few weeks, we'll do an inverse while she's on the road doing her business travels. I'll be at home. She'll still be holding things together virtually from the road, of course, because she's sort of the master strategist behind the scenes. But thank goodness for the modern marvels of technology. However, it's not so good for our date night.
Yes, it's not. But it's pretty good for Skyping. If for any parent that actually travels out there, my husband and I both have a really good tradition with our children that we minimally see them on Skype. So I feel like we've seen you, seeing how we've carried your head on the iPad all around the house, dear.
If I could just make one more comment on Skype, I love the technology. However, it's not really good for your own image when you're looking at it. I believe that your face is overinflated like by 3x on the screen as you're looking at yourself. And so we have an interesting show tonight, do we not?
As Jay had said, it's usually date night for us when we do the show. And again, we are the wife and husband duo. Yes, wife before husband, bringing you women news talk radio. We're committed to ensuring women are recognized in the media as equally as men. And Jay and I have two daughters, so we also know the importance of building that foundation for the next generation. If you can squeeze an hour to listen to us, you can also follow us on our social media. We can connect with you 24/7. You can find all our social media links on our website, www.ewnradionetwork.com/power-lunch. And you'll have also access to past podcasts, along with links to our social, to download our free mobile app. And you can find all that information on our Blog Talk Radio page as well. But as Jay had said, we have an interesting week. So Jay, did you see the new ads? Nike's hashtag Better For It campaign debuted this past week with a 60-second ad, which was created by Whedon and Kennedy. It was announced during last Sunday's MTV Movie Awards, which is, of course, great timing. And unlike other Nike campaigns, which usually focus on athletes, this campaign was actually focused on kind of just the everyday woman, and I watched the ads. They were pretty well done. They're very short. The hundreds of reasons that goes on in your head for either pushing yourself or not pushing yourself when you're working out. And they did a pretty good job of it. Well, Nike is very focused on women and targeting that segment. But campaign is called, again, the hashtag Better For It. And Nike's even taking it to the next level, where this past week they also launched a 90-day hashtag Better For It challenge, where they're asking women across the world and anyone who's taking part of it is to use that hashtag and then attach their own experiences, whether they are little mini clips or they just want to talk about what they're doing with their workouts. And of course, that you're going to use the Nike apps that they have, the Nike watches that they have, and the Nike gear. And so this is all to kick off a very concentrated effort, which is from Nike's perspective, not something that they want to do because they want to be nice to women. Jay, I mean, it's a lot more about the financials, about why they're targeting women, is it not?
Yeah, I think for the most part, they've done a pretty good job. Right? I know that when to purchase golf gear or tennis gear, Nike's got a very good product. Frankly, the financial success of the company so far, I mean, their market capitalization is $86 billion. They do $30 billion a year in revenue. They have a 10% profit margin, which, you know, manufacturing, they're producing goods, and so you see the hard good effect to that. They've had a 7% year-on-year growth. So I think they've done a good job, but I think this is trying to take them from good to great, if I can steal from Jim Collins. It's sort of the inverse of Spanx. Spanx has gone and done amazing things, as you've chronicled for so often, and now they're thinking about how do we break into the male gender side of the market.
Say that in looking at one of the articles that we had pulled from Business Insider, they're quoting that Nike believes they could add an additional sales by 2017. So in 2 years, they think they could add an additional $2 billion just by targeting women in this new ad. And it's not, to your point, it's not that they haven't ever focused on women before, but they, exactly like the NFL, they see it as their fastest growing segment. And they went from $5 billion at the end of the fiscal year, where they feel that they're going to end this year, to $7 billion in 2017. That's according to Bloomberg as well. They're actually opening a second women's-only store in Shanghai at the end of the month. They're not the only ones, so I'm going to say someone else who's also focusing on women as well. Under Armour recently passed Adidas to become the second largest sportswear brand in the U.S., also launched its largest ever global women's marketing campaign earlier this year, and they've signed deals with supermodels like Gisele Bündchen and ballerina Misty Copeland, and Lululemon, you know, my favorite yoga gear, is also offering a wider selection of styles and colors and prints, and is trying to improve its customer service, according to Reuters, to also step up and beef up foray for women looking at sports gear. And I think it's different than maybe a decade ago and maybe 5 years ago, because sportswear was really seen by men. If I could speak for myself, I'm one of the women new addition to sportswear. I would have never bought it to the consumption that I did 5 years ago, because number one, it was unstylish, it wasn't very comfortable. And if you were working out, you know, it was either the ugly sweats or something that was really uncomfortable, and you put it away as soon as you got home. Lululemon kind of took that to the next level by making it somewhat stylish. And so I do think that both Nike and Under Armour, but going back to Nike because it's their campaign that they launched this past week, and we'll put that on our social media sites, the hashtag Better For It campaign is very trendy. I do think that they're going to gather a lot more support and focus on it, because campaign itself does talk to your everyday woman and kind of the challenges she goes to. Under Armour, I think it's really smart by bringing on not athletes. I know that sounds kind of crazy. I think it's interesting that they're not using athletes from the women's launch, but rather supermodels and a ballerina to kind of really push that women's line.
If they're doing a 7% year-over-year growth and they're looking for, like you said, $2 billion in revenue, that's effectively another 6.5% increase on revenue. So they could, in other words, they could double their growth, because they grew 7% year-over-year without this campaign. And if they get the targets for this, they could double their growth just by going and getting deeper into women. And by the way, don't take too much credence away from the fact that I think some of the reasons you've gone deeper into golf and tennis is because the good-looking products that are out there. I almost feel like,
yeah, it's more attractive
looking, because it looks good.
Let's move on to something that's kind of close to sports, but it's not really. And we're talking about the first female Blue Angel. Her name is Captain Katie Higgins from the U.S. Marine Corps. And if you haven't seen the news, she was featured, I believe, in the Today Show this past week. She also was on CBS News. Now, the articles that came up, it's a little bit misleading, because she did actually get appointed last year to the Blue Angels, but she took her first flight in a show this past week in Pensacola. So that's where really she got the credit for being the first woman to fly with the Blue Angels, and that happened this past week. Now, Katie Higgins, a little bit about her, was a huge supporter of the military, especially having family members that still serve. She's no stranger to being a pilot, so it wasn't something that she had no experience in the sense of her family. Her father, her two uncles, and grandfather were all pilots. So when it came to her turn, she just felt like she was destined to also become a pilot as well. She's a 2008 Naval Academy graduate, so she's fairly young, and she's the first woman to ever perform in the Blue Angels history. So that was a pretty good, and it was a very feel-good story. If you haven't seen it, we'll post it on our social media site after the show so you can actually watch some of it.
Before we close, she's literally breaking through both figuratively and literally through the glass ceiling.
Absolutely. And speaking of another woman who's breaking through glass ceilings, something we also were a little bit surprised about, but she made headlines this past week on the FastCo, Fast Company, really good articles on women that you wouldn't normally hear in the mainstream media. Well, did you know that NASA's chief scientist is a woman? Ellen Stoffen is NASA's chief scientist, and she made the headlines this past week on FastCo because it was talking about NASA and where it needs to take itself, but also the fact that NASA itself really wanting to get more focus in getting the general public excited about space exploration, Mars, and aliens. Well, a little about her. She was born in Oberlin. Her field is in and focus is in planetary science. She went to College of William and Mary and Brown University. Her research has focused on the geology of Venus, Mars, Saturn's moon Titan, and Earth. She is an associate member of the Cassini Mission to Saturn radar team. She's a co-investigator, Mars Express Missions MARSIS. And she was also the principal investigator on the Titan Mar Explorer. So she's definitely, you know, looking for aliens for a pretty much a good part of her life. She's also received the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers, which is a pretty prestigious award appointed by the president. She's pretty adamant that we're going to find, even though she says the possibility of finding alien life is probable, that her quote is, it's going to be mind-blowing. And the reason why Ellen made the headlines again is a lot of the responsibility in terms of how they're going to achieve the goal of flying a manned spacecraft on Mars and landing astronauts on the planet, and how are they going to pay for it, and who can they turn to and partner with for the technologies, and then most importantly, how can they gain support from the public, the American public, about the difficulties, but more importantly, about the value of a distant, expensive, and quote, audacious mission. So that is Ellen Stofan's primary focus as the NASA chief scientist. And the article, again, that we'll post is a great insight into the challenge of a chief scientist. I mean, you know, there are jobs that I can fantasize about, and there are jobs that I could think about, oh, that would might be interesting. But this one caught my eye because you don't hear about a woman in NASA, nonetheless her being the chief scientist. And then to top it all off with icing on the cake, oh, by the way, you're responsible, Ms. Chief Scientist, for making sure that we land on Mars in 20 years in a manned aircraft. And she's not only excited about it, pretty cool to see that we have yet another trailblaze, but it's great to see that we've got a woman in science, especially when we're trying to get more and more young girls in the next generation focused on STEM, and to see somebody like Ellen kind of get the headlines. And I'm hoping that other major networks will take the time to interview her, get her story out there, because I think the only way that she's going to get the focus on NASA getting back up in space and getting the support is it's got to be more than just Fast Company that carries this article. Well, that's all we have on this first part of the segment. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about women in politics, Hillary's first week on the campaign trail, and what they did to Claire Underwood. More when we return.
Are you an entrepreneur, coach, or consultant who is tired of constantly searching for the next client? Are you ready to get your expertise out of your head, into the world, and packaged into a profitable online course that delivers a steady stream of your perfect ideal clients to your door and a steady, predictable source of revenue? Hi, this is Janine Blackwell, creator of Create Six-Figure Courses Virtual Bootcamp, and I've created my own seven-figure courses, and I've walked hundreds of experts like you through the step-by-step of creating and launching a profitable online course. I'd like to invite you to a free online training I'm hosting for you called The 7 Steps to Creating and Launching Your Profitable Online Course. I'm going to show you exactly how to create your course, market your course, and automate delivery of it so you can get your course up and running fast and have it work for you 24/7. You can grab your spot for this free training at www.createmyonlinecourse.com. So join me at www.createmyonlinecourse.com.
Did you know banks decline more commercial loans than they approve? In fact, national banks approve less than 20% of all business loans submitted. And that doesn't include the loans that don't even qualify. But at Inter Pares Capital, we are here to overcome those odds. We are a nationally recognized commercial brokerage firm with access to thousands of public and private lending institutions. That means we have more options to finance you than your bank does, whether you are a startup or in need of debt refinancing or growth capital. We can help. We do the heavy lifting so you can focus on running your business. Contact us today for a free consultation with one of our business advisors at 855-365-1930. At Inter Pares Capital, we are your business partner in finance.
You're connected to the EWN Radio Network.
Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network, your Power Lunch Hour keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Welcome to the Power Lunch, sponsored by Interpares Capital, your business partner for all your financing for your small business needs. I'm your host, Mona Lisa Como, and joined with my handsome co-host and hubby, Jay Como.
So we've had a good show so far. We've got Hillary to talk about. We've got politics. We've got Claire Underwood. We've got Equal Pay Day. We've got Netflix. We've got a host of things. Where do you want to go now?
Let's talk about Equal Pay Day. So this past week was interesting for a couple of days. And first, let me say, doesn't it seem like we have a lot of new days every year?
Birthday.
You know, like today is Donut Day.
Donut
Hug Your Mom Day. You know, last week was Sibling Day, right? I didn't know it was National Sibling Day on April 10th. And then Equal Pay Day was April 14th, the day before the tax day. Well, Equal Pay Day was originated by the National Committee on Pay Equity, NCPE, in 1996 as a public awareness event to illustrate the gap between men's and women's pay wages. Well, because women earn on less on average than men, they must work longer for the same amount of pay, which is what they're trying to focus on. And they're basically hoping that the awareness of the wage gap will actually bring to forth more legislation and also focus on how companies can do better in terms of equality of pay. So, Jay, what did you find out on it?
A couple of facts that I saw that I think are interesting, and then I've got a question for you. So the entire WNBA roster salary for all of the league is $10.3 million, and that is one-third of what Kobe Bryant makes in a year. Kobe Bryant is one player on a team with 12 players in the NBA, and then the whole league of the WNBA makes a third of what Kobe Bryant makes. I guess I would ask, without sharing too much, you've been in an industry that at some point's been really bad from an inequality perspective, and at some point perhaps and maybe individually been fairly, fairly good. And you're someone who's had a really good career, but I do think you face pay inequality. I think you can speak from both sides of this issue. I think that there are times where you can say pay inequality hasn't been an issue because I've done very well versus my male contemporaries, and then I think there are other times when it's been absolutely an issue. And just curious, kind of, you've been in the business, you're entrepreneurial now, you're your own CEO, but in your time in corporate America, what's your view on pay inequality?
It depends. I say that earlier in my career, I probably felt less of a pay inequality, and I think a lot of that had to do with location. I do think that there are some states, in all fairness, that do a better job than others. I do think companies that are located in certain areas of the United States, whether that's in New York or California or in the Bay Area or at Los Angeles, and I think it's industry related. So kind of to go back what you were saying, and it's ironic that this Equal Pay Day comes on the heels of the biggest gender bias for pay case with the Ellen Powell losing against Kleiner Perkins just a week ago. So I think that that's just kind of interesting timing. So I do think that there is for women, you know, that's why you've got the whole lean-in movement, that we know for a fact that women make less. And I think it's part of it has to do, at least in corporate America, that there is still bias, so to speak, and not an intentional bias, a bias to some extent where you're looking at a female executive or employee. But I think you tend to see that a lot in the executive ranks where women are judged differently. And I think it's going to take a couple of generations where when you see an aggressive woman, that she is not negatively viewed as saying, oh, well, you know, she's being a witch and she's got, you know, hormonal problems and she's just a horrible individual, or, you know, something even more sexist jokes about why she has that job. I mean, those are the things that I grew up with and, you know, my career having to combat that, and women ahead of me had it even worse. And I bring that up because I think that all goes into the pay. And then you also have, unfortunately, a lot of focus on a woman's marital status, right? So if a woman is married, especially if she's married to a seemingly successful husband, she doesn't need the money. But when a man is looking at his pay package, he's viewed as somebody who has to, you know, he's got to provide for the family. But a woman's pay is, I still think, in many places, in a generational thing, I think a woman's pay is seen as additional. It's not seen as primary. And then if you're a single mom, you are viewed as, okay, well, you have to provide for your family. But then there's still that bias, well, you know, but if you had a husband or, you know, child support. So I think that it is going to take a generation or two before you start to see that equality, at least from a corporate perspective. and in the private sector. I think where you'll see that there will be a little bit faster balance between pay is, you know, tennis is just, and why I love covering it, is it's great to see that tennis is more at equal pairing from a purse perspective than any other sport. And in fairness, back to your WNBA analogy, it's atrocious to see how low the pay is for the female NBA players. But if I'm an executive for Nike and the NBA, you almost can't justify paying the women higher salaries because you don't have the ad revenue, nor do you have the fan base to support these types of pay packages. So, for instance, the reason why Roger Goodell can get paid $40 million by all of the franchise owners in the NFL is because those franchise owners are making hundreds of millions of dollars from their fan base. I think the challenge, though, is to see if networks can start to cover, and because I think that LPGA is starting to do that, there definitely is more of a focus on how they can make it more attractive for the younger generation and getting out there and trying to give it equal airtime for some of their tournaments, because you have to watch it only on the Golf Channel, you're not going to watch it on NBC. So the LPGA is getting there. WNBA, I don't know if that parity happens, because in reading some of the articles with the WNBA, would you watch the or the WNBA? And it's not a sexist issue. You haven't seen it around as much, and I think it's that there's not enough saturation of the sport itself.
You're right. I mean, I think, you know, the NFL does $10.5 billion a year in revenue. The NBA does a ton of revenue. The WNBA doesn't. And so there's going to be
you
some
don't
inequality
have that
there.
Fan base.
It's nice to
right.
see where there's activity that the equality is starting to happen, like in tennis. And where I think it will go in golf. And frankly, in the UFC, if you look at those numbers, there's a fair bit of equality there. So it's nice to see it coming around. And there are going to be pockets that will just, they will never be equal, because it's not meant to be that way. I'll never be a great ballerina. I don't know if the WNBA will ever be as, it might only be a third as entertaining as the NBA. And I'd like to see that change, but it might not.
Right. So if you were talking about models, something tells me that the women models make far more than the male models, just because of there's more demand for women models. They're more known, but, you know, you Gisele Bündchen, we know her because she's a model. I mean,
you
and
pick
you
one
name
male model,
the models.
By the way, I
right,
challenge you
I
not to, because you might get in trouble.
I wouldn't. But the truth is no one comes to mind as male models. So there definitely isn't going to be a demand to see that equality from their pay package. You know, and then when you go to corporate America, I think there's some good signs out there, right? So Ruth Porat, remember we reported on her probably 3 or 4 weeks ago. She's Google's new CFO that came from Morgan Stanley. She got a $70 million pay package. I mean, $65 million in stock grants and a $5 million signing bonus and a yearly salary of $650,000 a year. I mean, booyah, that's a pretty impressive pay package. So I think that they're definitely, I think the Silicon Valley, the technology companies are starting to come around to see that. You know, when you've got the likes of Marissa Mayer, that's the head of Yahoo, and you've got Susan Wojcicki, who's the CEO of YouTube, and then you've got Meg Whitman, who's the CEO of HP, but I forget which HP, but the chair as well. I think that you're going to start to see that in companies where you have women. I think the challenge for the equality is twofold. I think, number one, we have to get more women moving up the food chain. It's the same thing with women in politics, right? You want to change the world, you've got to make sure that the people who you vote for are more representative of the reality of what the world looks like. I think that's the same thing with corporate America. The companies who are the most successful when it comes to equality of pay are the ones that have more diverse boards and the ones that have more diverse executive teams. But the truth is 90% of your workforce is male and 10% of your workforce is female. That's an uphill battle right there. It's kind of the same thing with the NBA. You've got more people that want to watch the male NBA than the WNBA, and therefore you're going to see more lucrative packages for the male players. So I do think that when you see somebody like Ruth Porat for Google, and you do see Mark Zuckerberg for Sheryl Sandberg, I think the tech Silicon Valley companies are trying to make a statement there. I think the Wall Street firms, you know, Sally Krawcheck is no longer in the industry, but she was one of the top female executives in the industry. Abigail Johnson, who's now the CEO of Fidelity. I think that's great news. That's a good sign for the financial services. Ginni Rometty, CEO of Big Blue, of IBM, and then you've got PepsiCo. So I think the more women executives you see and the more women on boards that you see, because the board is what hires the CEOs, that's why you've got to get more women on the boards, I think that's also going to result in equality of pay. And to kind of digress a little bit to one of the articles that I had read, you know, Time Magazine did an article this past week about the, what it was focused on was, it was a Life article, Life Before Equal Pay Day, A Portrait of a Working Mother in the 1950s. And it talked about how the progress for equal pay, because in the 1950s, it wasn't about equal pay. It was about the opportunity to work, because in 1956, only 16% of women with children worked outside of the home. So you've seen that transition, you know, the generations and the women before us and our mothers and our grandmothers paid for us. They were looking for the opportunity to work. They couldn't even get to the battle of equality of pay because they were still saying, I want to be able to get a job. There was an article I read probably a year ago where a college student had interviewed her grandmother about what she wanted to be in life. And it was eye-opening because the grandmother had said, well, honey, my choices and your choices were very different. When I went to college, I had two options. I could either be a secretary if I wanted to have a real job. I could only be a secretary or a school teacher. And the third one was a nurse, but that generally was reserved for like nuns. But there were only acceptable jobs for women in the 50s. And so they had to fight that battle to get to the point where now they're acceptable as executives and board members, and we're still fighting the equality of pay. So I know that I kind of, you know, went all around on that topic, but I do think that it's a complicated issue. I don't for one minute think that it's not something we should tackle, but I do think that equality of pay has got to come hand in hand with seeing more diversity at the executive levels and at the boards, because naturally you're going to have, with a diverse talent at those levels, those are the people who decide the pay comp packages for the companies, and they're the ones that are going to say, well, this doesn't look right, or we should be looking at this, and these numbers don't look right in terms of compensation for our employees.
And ultimately it comes down to getting more women on board, and then by proxy you'll have more women on compensation committee, you'll have more women on search committees, and that's the way to get it done. We can talk about it all we want, we can write about it, we can opine about it, but until it happens at the board level, then the trickle down from there, that's going to be game changing.
It is. And so I will talk about, before we go to break, so there is a young lady though, who I do think is earning her pay. You're going to like the story, and we like to bring you an entrepreneur every week because we think it's so exciting, and we're big advocates of more women entrepreneurs. Her name is Charlie, and she's making $127,000 a month, effectively $30,000 a week. She's 8 years old. So this was just posted in Entrepreneur Magazine yesterday. Ad Age recently published a ranking of the top YouTube stars according to the estimated monthly earnings. The data was compiled by Outrigger Media, who focus on the top earning channels in two genres, beauty and style, and food and cooking. And if you remember a couple of episodes ago, we talked about one, the number one YouTube star, Michelle Phan, who owns Ipsy, but she actually started her career on YouTube. The top earner in the food and cooking genre is a channel called Charlie's Crafty Kitchen, which features videos of an 8-year-old young girl named Charlie sharing baking tips. Can you believe this? Well, according to Outrigger's estimates, Charlie's channel generates an average of $127,000 a month in ad revenue. And that's taking into account YouTube's cut of the revenue. So that's not gross, that's net. The channel gets an average of 20 million views each month. In March, it had 29.1. Charlie began making her videos in 2012, so she was a whopping 6 years old. Her 5-year-old sister, Ashley, is her sidekick. She is the chief taste tester. It is absolutely adorable. I watched her YouTube, about 2 or 3 of her YouTube videos tonight with the kids. They were amazed, and now our youngest daughter just wants to continue watching it. She's very well animated, and they're very short YouTubes. They're like 2 minutes. They're not even very long. Well, the girls have made tutorials from everything from frozen Minnie Mouse Oreo Pops to Jell-O Popsicles inspired by Frozen. So I definitely encourage you to, as we're talking about equal people pay. I thought this was kind of a nice segue into an 8-year-old young girl. Remember, I said it takes a generation, right? So we're talking about the two top YouTube stars. The number one in beauty is a woman, and it's a young lady, Michelle Phan. And then the second one is this 8-year-old who's giving tips on baking. What do you say to that?
It levels you at how much life has changed just in 10 years. I mean, what YouTube is doing, publishing books, it's life is changing at the speed of light. And things that you weren't able to accomplish people are able to accomplish. And to think that an 8-year-old is making that much money for herself and her parents and for her college and for her future, and she's doing and having fun. She's not out there working in a field. It's not child labor. It's amazing. And God bless the consumerism into it and the purity of it. It's actually really nice to see. But the world's changed a lot, and it's a really great thing.
Well, I think it's wonderful, and congratulations to her and her family. So check it out. Charlie's Crafty Kitchens. We'll post it on our site. Give her a couple more views because this young lady has really earned it. Well, we're going to go to break. When we come back, we're going to finish up our show on Hillary's first week, and we're going to kind of segue that into Claire Underwood because we think there's a little bit of tie-ins into that, but it's an interesting perspective from both. So more when we return.
Hi, I'm Sandra Yancey, founder and CEO of eWomen Network. One of my mottos for business owners is, you can't do it alone. Whether you're in the startup stage of your business or you're scaling, you can't grow without relationships to provide support, wisdom, and new customers. eWomen Network is your home to connect with other women entrepreneurs who have been where you are or are experiencing the same challenges. We have chapters across the U.S. and Canada that have monthly events featuring our trademarked process called Accelerated Networking, to ensure you get the contacts, resources, and leads you need to grow your business. And once you become a member, you get many benefits, including 2 one-on-one coaching sessions, unlimited access to our membership database, your own personal profile page, and discounts on products and services with our business partners such as UPS and American Express Open. Join the eWomen Network community and let us help you live your dream. For details, visit eWomenNetwork.com.
Did you know banks decline more commercial loans than they approve? In fact, national banks approve less than 20% of all business loans submitted. And that doesn't include the loans that don't even qualify. But at Interpares Capital, we are here to overcome those odds. We are a nationally recognized commercial brokerage firm with access to thousands of public and private lending institutions. That means we have more options to finance you than your bank does. Whether you are a startup or in need of debt refinancing or growth capital, we can help. We do the heavy lifting so you can focus on running your business. Contact us today for a free consultation with one of our business advisors at 855-365-1930. At Interpares Capital, we are your business partner in finance.
You're connected to the EWN Radio Network.
She's smart. She's successful. She's an executive. She's an entrepreneur. And she's the chief executive of her story. Who is she? She's you. Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network. Your Power Lunch Hour, keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Welcome back to the Power Lunch. I'm your host, Mona Lisa Como, joined by my handsome co-host, Jay Como. Thanks for coming back from the break. When we left, we were talking about it was a very big political week. And as expected, ending 2 years of speculation and coy denials, and I'm quoting this from the New York Times, Hillary Rodham Clinton announced on Sunday that she is seeking the presidency, surprisingly, for the second time, immediately establishing herself as the likely 2016 Democratic nominee. She launched her campaign in a 2-minute video on social media. She did it on YouTube and on Twitter. And Jay, did you watch the 2-minute video?
I did, and I would just say, dating myself, I loved John McCain in 2000 before George Bush got elected, you know, in the Republican primaries. And when he ran again and for the 2008 election cycle against Obama, he just wasn't the same guy. I mean, that was his year and he didn't get it. And you know, I wish he would have, but he didn't. And he just was a different campaigner. And And I don't know how good of a president Hillary might have made, but frankly, I would have to think she'd be better than what President Obama has done. It's just, it's not really been a good year on a lot of different angles, and you could debate that, but there's, no matter what, no matter how you are, there's certainly a lot that's not gone well. There was a time when I thought that she, first of all, was going to win the Democratic primaries, and I thought that she'd actually be better than McCain because of my disdain for the way that he ran his campaign back in those days. And I thought she ran a great campaign during the primaries of the 2008 election. And frankly, and we've talked about this on this show, if Florida had not changed their primaries and had those votes eliminated, I think she would have probably won the nomination. And we'd be talking for the last 6-7 years about the first woman president, not the first black president. And so it didn't happen, right? Those are the woulda, coulda, shoulda, and there was bad circumstances and unfortunate circumstances for Hillary Clinton. I mean, I saw her release. I've seen the news since then. Time's gone. It was gone for McCain in 08. It's gone for her and Fiend. You miss a boat. I mean, it's gone for Romney every time you miss a boat. So, you know, it's great that she's fighting for it, but the time's gone.
Well, I think it's interesting that you bring that up. So I'm going to quote a little bit from this article that the New York Times did and then also touch upon some of the media that's happened since then. So on Sunday, the article that the New York Times wrote, it just basically Hillary announces the 2016 presidential bid. I was expecting, because it was the Times, that it was going to be somewhat of a coronation promotion of her. And surprisingly, because I don't necessarily agree, I think they're a little too left-leaning sometimes in their reporting. And I don't, just understand for our listeners, I just don't like journalists that have to show their bias too strongly. I prefer reading the news and coming up with the opinion on my own. And it's really hard to read these days. And a lot of news media, you see and can hear the tinge of the personal views of the writer as opposed to just reporting on it, which is why I prefer just reading anything from the AP. So fast forwarding the New York Times article, it gave a little bit of a backdrop comparing and contrasting for everyone. Remember, we went through this 8 years ago, right? She, to your point. And 8 years ago, she was an extraordinary, and I'll quote from this, she was an extraordinary public figure at the time, was President Bill Clinton. I mean, President Bill Clinton had his own following. He was the first kind of hip president. And even though he had the sexual scandals, she still had that Mrs. Clinton appeal. And then on top of that, you then have her leaving the White House and effectively getting the New York Senate seat without so much as living there, and that creating a lot of controversy, but that was somewhat muted. It was almost like the country forgave her. She left the office. You know, had it been any other politician, and I don't think, for instance, Michelle Obama gets the same thing as well. If Michelle Obama wanted to go to Hawaii and run for senator, the Hawaiians might allow her to do it. But I think that the public would be critical, saying, you know, that you're kind of acting like you should deserve it, when in fairness, there are some people that have been working in the state for very long that have fought for the state. So Mrs. Clinton, I think, and Hillary has definitely benefited from Democrats that have kind of bowed out because she's the former first lady. And then also, I do think that there was a sense of guilt across the United States for having publicly seen her go through this humiliation with her husband. I mean, come on. Who has to go through that except Eleanor Roosevelt when he had his mistress out there? So there was definitely, I think, a sense of, hey, we'll forgive her. She gets the New York seat. It's only the people in New York that really wanted that seat that had been working all of these years that we felt bad for. So then you fast forward to the 2008 campaign, and I was going to vote for her. Still, I still thought that the campaign that she ran back then was still a lot more classier, and it was less below the belt, and she was, because she had held that air, an aura of ladylike, she was very professional. There wasn't a lot of crap out there. We were just hearing about her. We knew what her views were in terms of healthcare because she had tried to do that with her husband. We all admired her resiliency, the fact that she could bounce back and could compete in the campaign. And not for nothing, to be fair, Barack fought a pretty ugly fight. I mean, one of the first things that really irritated me with his campaign is when they were making fun of her making tea, right? And I mean, that was a very sexist comment. Or when Chris Matthews came out during the campaign and accused Hillary of pimping out Chelsea to get votes. I mean, if you want to talk about sexism in the media, what they did to Hillary in 2008 was atrocious. It's almost kind of, it will never be as what happened, hardly as bad as what happened with Monica Lewinsky in the media. But the media had a lot of sexist commentary because they wanted Barack to win, and Hillary never got that opportunity. So we saw her humiliatingly lose, which I swear to you, I remember you and I talking about this 8 years ago. I never thought she'd lose the nomination because she was Hillary Clinton. And yet she did. She came third in Iowa behind John Edwards, who, I don't know, is he in jail right now or something? Because I think he lied and he stole money. And I mean, we're talking about John Edwards. So Hillary couldn't even get the primary nomination. Now, to your point, she lost Florida and could have won it, but she, in Iowa, she came third. So that shows you that even among the Democratic voters who had the choice to pick their candidate, she didn't win that candidacy. And so then you fast forward the last 8 years to what's happened with her being Secretary of State, and maybe a little bit of, oh, wow, we're just all proud of her, because one of the articles said, hey, you know, she took Democrats in general were shocked when she took the position as Secretary of State because of how nasty the fight with her and Barack Obama was. And I remember thinking, okay, now that he's won, he's going to name Hillary as his VP, which he didn't do. So there was an opportunity for Barack to name her as the VP, which probably she would have never taken. So now you're here. Barack is done with his term. Do feel personally that maybe the Democratic Party feels that they owe her, hence nobody contending her, and I don't think anybody will argue that. But her first week now trying to rebrand herself, and so Wolf and Jay, a little bit of commentary on that. Her first week, not so good, right? She wanted to rebrand herself. She came out with a video saying, I want to be one of you. Let me get her quote exactly, because it was an interest. Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion. So I'm hitting the road to earn your vote because it's your time, and I hope you'll join me on this journey. End of quote. That's Hillary's. That doesn't sound like her. What do you think?
Hillary Clinton, don't tell me that you're going to be able to connect with middle-class America. You have no clue what middle-class America is. I mean, I prefer for her to campaign the way that she did in 2008. Just come out.
That
be who you
here are.
You've got a great resume. You've got great ideas. You've had some missteps. You're either going to say that I can overcome them and I'll run the candidate that I am. I met an operative once. I was smoking a cigar in Phoenix, and I met an assemblyman from Arizona who was close to John McCain. Now, they're different sides of the party, but this individual was part of the political establishment. And we were smoking a stogie and talking, and he said, John didn't run his campaign the way that he is. He let outsiders come in and run his campaign, and it wasn't who he is. And this gentleman said, I know John, and I certainly don't know him, obviously. But this gentleman said, I know John, that was not him. I'd say the same thing, Hillary, this isn't you. Be genuine, come out and get the best you could be as you were in the last time when you should have won. And if you don't got that moxie, then don't wire you in. Let's not try to be something we're not. And this last week has been, I don't know if it's trying to take us away from the email server issue, away from Benghazi, which no one's talking about now. So that's actually to her advantage that we're not talking about Benghazi anymore. And I personally think we should, but we're not. But I don't know what this is. This abomination of her candidacy as a candidate
for a Democratic voter. So, you know, I'll kind of play on that side for a bit. This past week, as she had stated, she wanted to hit the road. So she had said that she was going to attempt to show that she is one of the people. Her campaign advisor said, hey, let's not roll out the big luxury van and entourage that we're normally used to. Like, first off, let's all remember, she's still the former first lady. And because Bill is her spouse, she will have Secret Service until the day she dies. So that's inevitable. She had said, and I quote, you know, I'm hitting the road with my, quote, Scooby-Doo van, is what she calls her campaign van. And she was going to go all over Iowa. Well, she's only been on the road for a week. And the reason why she's starting to get a lot of negative press is she had said that she wants to meet everyday Americans. The news has come out that, number one, it's not town hall type events. They're very staged events, which, okay, to her credit, and I think even Bill O'Reilly had made this comment in her defense, saying, you know, Hillary, while she's getting criticism, she doesn't have to prove herself because she's most likely going to be uncontested. So from now until the presidential race, she doesn't have to go out there with these big events because She already, public knows who she is, so she can afford the ability to be very private and be very selective and not shaking hands and kissing babies with everybody out there. So in essence, she kind of earned her celebrity status to kind of be withdrawn. But to Jay's point, and I think for our listeners, is going again against what Hillary said she wants to do. So she's trying to brand herself as somebody of the people, and that's the, in fairness, that's not the woman that we've all grown to know over the years. Secondly, you back that up with the fact that she will unequivocally have the largest war chest of any campaign, $1 billion to date, and they're expecting her to raise $2 billion. You can feed a lot of people with that, but more importantly, if you're pretty confident that you can win the race with that kind of money, when you're bragging about that type of war chest, in my mind, if I was a Democratic voter and I was voting for her, I would be frustrated saying, listen, we don't need to hear about the billions that you're raising. I would rather you brag about the fact that you're taking $10 here, but even not, then say you don't need any more campaign money. How about that? Why don't you say, hey, I've got it. You know, I want to show people that I'm an everyday American and I can understand your frustrations. And if you want to donate to my campaign, I'd rather you donate to this cause and to this cause because, you know, $1 billion is the most anyone's ever raised in a campaign. And now we're going to raise $2 billion. You don't need $2 billion for this. And she might not win, to be fair, because it's not a guarantee. And then lastly, her showing for this week. So they're bragging about the Scooby-Doo van. They're bragging about the fact that she wants to be one of the people. So again, this is coming from her campaign people, so I blame them a lot, in fairness. The third element you have is she's not telling the press about where she's going to go, right? So she's, instead of saying, okay, I'm going to be on these campaign stops for the next 8 days, you guys can meet me there, and I'm going to be at this house and this house and this house, I'm going to be here. She's been telling them kind of after the fact so that she can control what the media has to say. There's a clip that's gone viral this past week. She decided to go to Chipotle. Who cares, right? She's going to Chipotle. She has to eat. Apparently, this is important because if you're trying to be one with the people, which was what the pundits are saying and the critics, and they're even joking about it, is that she went in there with her sunglasses because she didn't want to be recognized. And it wasn't like a normal campaign food stop where you shake hands and kiss babies with everybody in the hamburger joint and everybody in the diner. And you go, she didn't want anybody to know who she was. She came in through the back door and she ordered her food and she left. She didn't acknowledge the people. And she, the only reason why the media knew about this is because the Chipotle folks released the video of the camera showing her actually ordering her food. So for week one, I think of a branding effort, to kind of boil it down, that's not a really good rebranding. If you're going to rebrand yourself, you kind of have to stick to it. But I think, Jay, to your point, more importantly, that isn't who she is. And the core of who Hillary Clinton is she's been a first lady, she's been secretary of state, she's been a senator, she is a career politician, she has had the last 25 years with Secret Service, which means she can't go to a bathroom without Secret Service clearing it, and I should know this having bumped into first ladies at operas and other events. You can't even go to the bathroom with people like the first ladies or folks that have Secret Service. They have to clear the bathroom and make or have a separate bathroom before you can even walk in. And that when they leave office. And so if you are in an environment where you're saying you're in a Scooby-Doo van, well, you're not in a Scooby-Doo van when you have the Secret Service clearing your path and the fact that they're the ones riding in there. So I do think, to your point, she's going to struggle with this rebranding. And I think what everyone should be fearful of is, because they've already kind of forgotten about this, the same type of hoopla and energy that she had in 2008 is what she has right now. The only difference is she doesn't have a contender on the Democratic side, but that doesn't mean they're going to win.
Yeah, and she will have a contender. I still think Evan Bayh. I still think Martin O'Malley. I still think there's talk from the right about Joe Manchin. Like what the right typically does is they look for the most, and maybe I'm guilty of this as well, they look for the most balanced, moderate Democrat that could run, and they trump them up. I don't know. I guess I could admit that perhaps I'm a little guilty of that, but I don't think Martin O'Malley is anywhere near center. I think he's left of center. I just like his pedigree. I frankly like Hillary's pedigree. She's got an amazing, amazing resume. She's so much more qualified than a lot of people out there. It's just, I think she's butchering herself. I just don't know if she can ever recover from Florida. There was a time for her to win the presidency, to make history as the first female president of the United States, and she got robbed. And I don't know if now, 8 years later, and now it's trying to make up for a lot of time and doing things that I don't think are natural for her and letting people run campaigns, putting her in a comfort zone, like you said, this new rebrand. I just don't think it's working.
Yeah, and we're going to wrap up on this. There will be enough to cover on Hillary throughout the next, 18 months. We talked about this a while ago, and Jay and I are very, very devout, or were, let me caveat that, House of Cards fanatic. House of Cards Season 1, wow. House of Cards Season 2, whoa, you know, whoa, it got even edgier. And then House of Cards Season 3 came. And so we're hoping, spoiler alert, if you haven't watched all the episodes, where are you? Where have you been? If you're watching House of Cards, just get it out of the way. If you have watched it, we'll refresh your memory because it's probably been a month because you probably did the binge that we did the weekend it came out. And we were good enough to at least spread it over 2 weekends so we could see our children. But first start on this, Claire Underwood, one of the things that I liked about her and a little bit of tie-in, I do believe that the Claire Underwood character was created in an image of Hillary Clinton. I don't say they're exact, in an image. The fact that she was a powerful woman, the fact that she was somewhat had her own career, the fact that she was seen as more of a cutthroat individual and somewhat of an apathetic relationship and a husband that was a cheater. And for all of the salacious things that, you know, the Clintons were in the media and on the tabloids, that's kind of what, in my mind, House of Cards took from it. Now, what I liked about House of Cards and what I loved about House was the fact that it was so evil. I mean, I watch TV to be entertained. That doesn't mean I endorse their behaviors. If you want a character who doesn't necessarily represent somebody in real life, because that would be just crazy. So I did enjoy the Claire Underwood of Season 1 and Season 2. By the end of Season 2, I really started to believe, which is why I was excited for her becoming the First Lady, is I really started to believe that the main culprit behind the evilness and the main puppet master of the Underwoods was actually Claire. And I thought, wow, going into watching Season 3, this is going to be so exciting. Here I was thinking Claire was just this wonderful, very supportive, somewhat naive, sees only the good in her husband kind of individual, because that's kind of what I got in the first couple of episodes. And then when I saw that she wasn't that way, and then the way she handled herself with her employee in the second episode, and how she endorsed a lot of the behaviors that never Frank was starting to lose himself and becoming a little bit weak and maybe more human, Claire would step in and literally kick the crap out of him. She'd smack him and tell him to, like, snap out of it, I don't like you this way. So that was exciting, again, going into Season 3. And then we saw Claire as First Lady. And I will tell you, and Jay heard me, had to hear this in 3D stereo the entire time, huge disappointment.
Well, I agree. There was a scene in, might have been Season 1, where he was kind of groveling, Frank Underwood, Kevin Spacey's character, and she said, "Don't grovel, my husband doesn't do that," you know, insinuating my husband's stronger than that. And her having to be the behind-the-scenes woman reminding him that, hey, you're strong. And that was amazing. I mean, I can certainly identify any of my weak moments in my corporate career. I was picked up by you saying, that's not how you roll. And so that hit home. And that, there was this inner strength there. Her character was basically, when he started to fray and unravel, she was the one who tied it all back together. And it wasn't just being a good wife. It was so much more than that. It was her tying it back together, being a good wife, but that was really sort of a byproduct. The reason she was tying it together was because if he was unraveling, then their plan, their mission, their goal, what they had set out for decades, and they had calculated every single step, every move on the chessboard had been planned out years in advance. And that was their goal, their lifelong goal, as they, from a married couple, from the beginning to where they were in this series, planned out with her driving it and reminding. And by the way, he was a big driver too. But if he started to unravel, she would wind him back up, not just because she was a good wife, because that's what needed to happen for them to execute on their plan. And then Season 3 comes along, and you've got 27 years of this marriage. She starts to unravel. She starts to fray wildly, and I don't know if that's sort of a shot at him as a husband not being able to rein her in, although he tried, so I don't think it's that. I read one of the reviews is that the writers, it's almost as though the writers didn't watch Seasons 1 and 2. And clearly, in my view, I agree. There was a scene where there was a gay rights activist who was imprisoned in Russia, and she spent the night in his room, and he committed suicide while she was asleep.
You're right.
And then they go into a press conference, and the Russian prime minister was pretty pissed about it, and it was a big deal. There was a UN deal going on in the Middle East that was tied to the whole thing, and they basically went into damage control mode and said, you know, this is how we're going to handle it. And she bucked the trend and put her husband as the president of the United States, his career in jeopardy, her career in jeopardy as a politician, because she, at this point in this series, she was an ambassador to the UN, put national security at risk for someone she didn't know. These characters would never fall on the sword for someone they didn't know. By the way, they wouldn't fall on the sword for someone they did know. 180. And even back to her being the ambassador to the UN, she pushed him when he disagreed and didn't think it was a good move. She pushed him to do it. And then when there was no support, she pushed for a recess appointment. Now, recess appointments happen, but it's generally not a popular way to go.
And that was a nepotistic, right?
Yeah, you lose credibility going in. And so it wasn't even a good political, and the whole thing was under the auspices of, we need to line my political career up. And frankly, if you want to see life sort of upstaging art in this situation, the way that the writers kind of wrote out how she's going to cultivate her career after having a backseat to his was a recess appointment as ambassador of the UN. Come on. Hillary at least went and got elected, and she was a carpetbagger. She wasn't even from New York, and she got elected to the Senate in New York and got appointed Secretary of State. And frankly, we all should have made a stronger run as the President of the United States, and is going to run now. And that's how you do a first woman who becomes her own entity, not in the way that I think that season 3 for House of Cards tried to do it. And it's a shame, because everything that was great and strong, and look, we have to be careful and hedge the way we say great, because there were some real devious aspects of their characters. That's entertainment, but the strength of their characters got blown up.
Right, and I would use a word to describe Clara that I would have never thought could be in my vocabulary watching season 1 and 2. She was wishy-washy, and she was flighty, and to your point, it defied the logic. I literally had felt the one article that you had commented, Jay, where it says that they did these, you know, you almost felt like they didn't watch season 1 and 2. I kept thinking, oh, it makes sense because they must have had a brand new writer, right? That's the only thing could make sense, because to your point, the Claire that was introduced to us in season 1 and 2 was an extremely powerful and confident woman. She had her insecurities and vulnerabilities about the rape, which, you know, was begged to question if that was a power play in this episode and in this season as well. But the very first Claire that we see is the Claire that's almost pouting about not getting a title that she thought was worthy. She's completely foregone the power of First Lady as its own right. What blew me away was that I didn't remember that the First Lady has its own political career as well. Being a First Lady is a full-time job. So for her to walk in the office and say, now you're president, but I need my own career, you do have a career. You're the First Lady of the United States. So you have this Claire that defies logic. The Claire in the first 2 seasons talked ad nauseum about wanting to get to the White House. Frank Underwood even mentioned that in this season 3. You're telling me that Claire Underwood would have never fathomed what her role as First Lady would have been had she been point? And they finally achieved nirvana in their career, and she goes off and says, oh, well, I need a career of myself, and I want the UN secretary, which was blasphemous at the time when it came out, they said it on the episode. And then when they appointed her in it, I thought, okay, now I was already irritated by the end of it when she had to go to Capitol Hill and defend herself, and then she loses her cool, and yet she still, even after she humiliates herself on the Hill, that the Frank Underwood from season 1 and season 2 wouldn't have said, hey, that's political capital, that damage that could go against us, let's not do this. A more devious Frank Underwood from season 1 and season 2 would have told Claire, and Claire, had she gone so crazy and wanted this, that hey, that we can't afford this, it doesn't look good. But they continue with that plot line, to your point, where she's now this, all of a sudden she grows a heart and wants to care about this gentleman that's exiled in Russia, who she says, no, I'm not leaving unless you come out with me. And then he winds up hanging himself in his cell. And then she goes out, the Claire Underwood, who's totally composed and apparently has no feelings in season 1 and 2. Then in season 3, when he hangs himself, she breaks down and cries in front of the press. I mean, this is after she already loses her cool and gets emotional on Capitol Hill. So by the time this gentleman had killed himself in that episode. I think that was, what, 5 or 6. I remember saying to you, Jay, I don't know what they're doing, but I'm going to keep watching because I'm sure there's an explanation for this, right? Something's going to happen to make sense of what has happened to Claire and Frank Underwood, because we could probably do a different show on what has happened to Frank, but Claire's made no sense. And we had an opportunity, I think, in the media to really put a strong woman in there. And I would have far more preferred that this Claire Underwood in season 3, they would have played out the whole puppet master and she's really the one controlling the White House, even though Frank is out there really doing all of the heavy lifting and taking all the flack. But really, I almost said Hillary, believe it or not. It's really Claire that's behind the scenes. Your last and final thoughts.
I guess we have to wait to see if season 4 is going to redeem itself. I am committed to it, but...
You're optimistic.
I have hope. 3 was rough. Hopefully they're setting us up, but I don't like what they did to her. I think what you said, wishy-washy, I think that's good. By the way, the writers are getting their butts kicked right now. Feedback isn't... It's not just us on this podcast. It is everyone. No one has come out in defense of 3, so we'll see where 4 goes, but I'm willing to give it a shot. Just my kind of public endorsement, but I think they wasted 3. It's unfortunate, but there's one shot to redeem it. Here's the difference, right? This is not life imitating art at this point, right? The writers in Netflix, who we were going to go into their earnings, but we've gone over on the show, so maybe we'll talk about it next week, right? Netflix has one more chance to get it straight with House of Cards. I'm sorry, but Hillary doesn't have another chance. I don't think, in my opinion. Just like I didn't think McCain had a chance in 08, and I just...
Well, isn't historically, I think you were the one that told me the stats on it, Americans generally, voters don't generally go for people who've lost before, right?
We like winners.
It's hard to vote.
We like winners, and now we're talking about voters. We're not talking about you and I as television connoisseurs, which we don't do a lot of. That's why it's fortunate you can do it over 2 weekends and you're done and you're not committed to sitting on the couch. But by the way, that's why we don't like season 3. We like winners. They weren't winners in season 3. Americans like winners. No matter how much those that don't love our nation say we're not winning, right? Americans that aren't proud of superiority of our nation, a majority of people do like to be winners, right? We all want to win. And
you know, interesting, I'm going to tie this to what a show that you like. I actually read, and sorry to interrupt you, I actually read somewhere that the reason why there's such a following, and there was a compare and contrast between The Walking Dead as well as House of Cards, is that, to your point about we like winners, even though The Walking Dead is apocalyptic, there's a sense of hope that every week we're going to win. And so you've got that sense of we're winners, we've survived another week, or so-and-so has survived, and there's always, you know, it could be far worse, even though every time I've watched it with you, I don't know how it could be, you know, it seems so bleak. But the people like yourself who are devout to it, there's this sense of hope. Because to your point, you like winners and you like to see that there's survivors with these people who are facing all different odds. You're absolutely right in your summation of what's gone on with season 3. To the writer's credit, though, he did agree with you in the sense that he felt that 2 seasons of evilness and domination was unrealistic in real life, and that he needed to right the wrong of the 2 seasons and balance it out with a very heavy-handed ass-whooping, so to speak, for the Underwoods as the first family.
And he certainly accomplished that.
You just don't know if you want to see them again as getting their butts kicked in 4, right?
I just hope the wrongs have been righted now. We can go back the ways of 1 and 2, and time will tell soon enough.
All right. Well, that's all we've got, folks. So we're going to continue our focus on the campaign. We're also going to hope that we see more entry of women from any party into the campaign, whether it's Democrat, Republican, or even Libertarian, or, you know, Greenpeace. But we'd hope that we could see more candidates throw their name in the hat, because this is the greatest democracy on this earth. Thanks for joining us this week. We hope you have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.